from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the city of Rochester earlier this month. Somewhere, a young man overdosed on opioids. His friend was in possession of Narcan, the brand name for an overdose reversal drug called Naloxone, and it saved the man's life. This is just one of the scenarios that has been playing out more often in Western New York. The opioid epidemic has killed hundreds of people in recent years, so the medical community has been training the public on Narcan, and that's at least part of the reason why 2018 saw the first decrease in opioid deaths in recent years. That does not mean the trend will definitely continue. There are still dozens of opioid overdoses on a monthly basis. Several presidential candidates have released plans to address the opioid epidemic nationwide. Senator Elizabeth Warren has released the most comprehensive plan that covers the next 10 years. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand has proposed limiting the supply of initial opioid prescriptions for acute pain to 7 days. This hour, a conversation about the crisis, the proposals, what we know so far about what works, and what's next in our community. Our guests include Dr. Michael Mendoza, Monroe County Public Health Commissioner. Dr. Mendoza, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Apostolakis is here, Chief Medical Officer for the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And our colleague Laura Garrison is back with us in studio, Vice President for Development at WXXI in the Little Theater. And Laura joined us at a program last year when we were talking about long-term chronic pain and care for chronic pain. I always enjoy seeing you, by the way.
Oh, it's always a pleasure seeing you.
Whether we're overseas on an airplane or here in studio.
Wherever it is.
Wherever it is. And Laura's here because you're someone who've been using opioids for chronic pain for a while?
20 years.
For 20 years.
Or more.
Okay, so there's a lot of perspectives at the table here. Let's just kind of start with where we are, because I know, listeners, you've probably heard we've seen a decrease in the number of opioid deaths. I'm going to give you a few statistics, and I'll turn it over to the doctors in the room to talk a little bit about this. So back in 2011, there were 11 opioid overdose deaths in Monroe County. 2015, the number was up to 85. 2016, 206. 2017, 287. And then last year, 2018, down to 195. So from 287 at the peak, 195. That is a big number still. But that is a significant decrease in a 1 year period. Dr. Mendoza, I know you've talked about why you think that is. Give me your broad outlook at your first reaction to seeing that number.
Well, as you know, we're dealing with an acute crisis. The opioid overdose crisis is really one that's affected every community in the nation. And I think we're heading in the right direction. You know, the fact that Narcan is out there, we believe people are using it. You know, as we'll get into later, there's really no good way to prove how much it's being used. But, you know, there's really only one reason. If we're seeing overdoses and people surviving from them in greater proportion, you know, the best guess is that that's due to Naloxone.
Okay. And when it comes to Narcan, Narcan, Naloxone, same thing,
yep.
Right? What do you want to see happen in terms of the spread of the availability and the training on that? I mean, how satisfied are you so far?
I think we need to keep going. You know, quite frankly, my worry when you see the numbers go down as they have is that people will start to get complacent. And now is not the time to get complacent. As you mentioned, we still have 195 fatalities, and that's still by every measure far too many for a community of any size. And so I think we need to keep the foot on the gas and, if anything, expand how much we're educating the public about Narcan and its use in the public setting.
Dr. Apostolakis, what was your response when you saw that decrease in numbers?
Well, I agree with Dr. Mendoza. It's a great start. It's giving us hope that what we're doing and what we're setting forth with educating our patients on the use of Naloxone and increasing prescriptions for Naloxone is having an effect.
Now, there's a number of things that are going to happen in any community dealing with this. There's prevention, there's prosecution, and there's everything in between. This hour, we are going to talk about the pain management aspect that you can't get away from. And I think it's important to understand people like Laura and your story, because part of the proposals here, Senator Gillibrand, let me go ahead and read with what Senator Gillibrand is proposing. She wants a limit on prescriptions, a bill that would create a 7-day prescription limit for opioids so that no more than a 7-day supply may be prescribed to a patient at one time for acute pain, such as a wisdom tooth removal or a broken bone. The intention would be to help restrict the excess supply of opioids and help minimize the risk of abuse. And I'm going to read the quote from Senator Gillibrand on this. "Too many families throughout New York and our country have suffered from the devastating consequences of the opioid epidemic. No community has been left untouched, and we need to be proactive when it comes to ending the crisis. One of the root causes of opioid abuse is the overprescription of these powerful and addictive drugs. I'm proud to join with Senator Gardner," she's citing one of the co-sponsors, "to introduce bipartisan legislation that limits the overprescription of opioids. This would help our communities combat opioid addiction, and I urge my colleagues in Congress to pass the bill," end quote. And her office points out this 7-day prescription limit would not necessarily apply to the treatment of chronic pain, pain being treated as part of cancer care, hospice care, or other end-of-life care, or pain treated as part of palliative care. What do you make of that?
So I just don't believe that medication prescription should be legislated. I think that pain is such a unique circumstance to every single person who experiences it. And how can you tell that because someone's pain is from a dental thing, that in 7 days that's going to be gone? Perhaps there's extensive dental work. Can you renew that prescription? What can you do? The medication issue is strictly between a patient and their doctor. Now, is there a crisis? Absolutely. Has that been caused in part by overprescription? You bet. No question about it. So I think that the doctors and patients themselves had to be educated. When I first started taking pain medication years ago, the theory was is that if you were in pain and you were taking pain medication, you would never become addicted. We now know that that was really a fallacy, that that's not true at all. But what is the difference between being addicted to something and not being addicted to something and being able to take pain medication responsibly? That's something that has to be between a patient and a doctor, and I think it would be completely inappropriate to legislate those kinds of issues.
More than 20 years you've been taking opioids
That's
for pain.
Correct.
What kind of impact has that had on your life?
Well, you know, it's actually allowed me to come to work every day and do all the things that I want to do. Now, I do not take opioids every day, but when I was at a point in my life before hip surgery where I was taking, like, so many opioids, you couldn't even believe it. Why I didn't become addicted, I have no idea. It didn't happen for me.
Well, the doctors will tell us. Maybe it's DNA. I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that. But I did not become addicted, and I continue to take opioids on an as-needed basis. But, of course, I've been educated by my doctors to realize that that should not be the first thing I do when I feel pain. There are other methods that you can use, and exercising and all kinds of things that you can do in order to stop that pain. And that opioid should be your last resort medication.
It's a break glass in case of emergency?
Sort of, yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. But it's still central to at least have that tool in your life to maintain quality of life?
Yeah. Right. Because, like, there are times where I cannot sleep at night. So after, like, say, you know, 6 or 8 Tylenol or something like that, and I still can't sleep, and I am in such pain that I'm just walking around because I cannot stand the pain, then I take an opioid. But otherwise, I don't know that I could be working. I don't know that I could be doing all the things that I like to do. I love to travel. I'm out there all the time. And I do feel that it is part of the overall picture of what you have to do. And if you go to things like end-of-life issues, my father suffered also from arthritis and all kinds of things, and towards the end of his life, he was in constant pain. So he took opioids regularly, every day, multiple times a day. But he was 93. And truly, if he got addicted, you know, I don't know that that's such a horrible thing.
Senator Gillibrand, though, I mean, I can't speak for her, but she would probably say, I'm hearing you, but this legislation is aimed at acute and incidental kind of needs, not chronic long-term.
Well, I think that you're going down a slippery slope when you start legislating things because I hear her saying that, but then the next step is that you have doctors who are not prescribing. I already have not great difficulty, but difficulty getting any kind of serious narcotics. What I'm taking is basically Tylenol 3 or 4 so that it's not anything really heavy duty, and I'm okay with that. But some people, that's not enough of medication for them. And even the last time I went into the office, they are randomly drug testing almost every patient who goes in there too. So it's really interesting how the doctors are reacting to the whole opioid crisis. And I think that the doctors, we can take care of it, and through good public health education and through education of the general public, I think that this is something that can be taken care of. And you can see the statistics are showing that it's improving. I mean, believe me, there's still a crisis. We still have a problem. But I think that legislating issues that really should be between a doctor and a patient, it's really tough. I mean, we're having the same issue, and I don't want to start bringing this up, but like in abortion, where, you know, okay, so this is okay. Then, okay, well, maybe that's not okay. Maybe we should go to this. So I think that the minute you start legislating what you can or can't do in pain medication, it creates problems.
Dr. Mendoza, the proposal by Senator Gillibrand on that 7-day limit, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that's consistent with a lot of the guidelines around acute pain management. And as you mentioned, you know, the devil's in the details. And, you know, I would think that with any, you know, regulation like this, there's always going to be an exception, and you should be able to override if needed. This is really, I think, intended to sort of create a starting point for people. And then, you know, you got to use your clinical judgment. And so the way we treat individuals like yourself or any of my patients has to be individualized to the particular circumstances and that person's condition and so forth. But when you look at it on a population level, which is, you know, my primary concern, you know, I think there's good logic behind legislation like this.
Okay. Now, Laura is saying, you know, she has needed it for years, doesn't take it every day. At one point was taking a lot, never became addicted. Not sure why she didn't get addicted. Is that in the DNA? Is that just how we are built?
You know, we know that addictions, you know, origins are complicated. There is a good bit of it that's genetic, and we have no way of knowing. And it sounds like you've done very well with that. People exactly in your circumstances have not done well, and we have no way to know. And, you know, that is the challenge that we're facing. And, you know, I've been in this long enough to see the pendulum go multiple times back and forth. You know, we've got to figure out the right happy medium. And I think, you know, we're still kind of going back and forth. But I do think it's not a choice. You know, you to have addiction or to not have addiction, it's not that you wanted it or anybody wants it. You know, it's
same
one
thing
of those
with alcoholism.
Things. Absolutely.
Right?
It's a disease. And, you know, nobody wants to have diabetes or heart failure. You know, it is a very complicated disease, and, you know, I think people who are struggling through it need compassion and help.
Dr. Apostolakis, what do you make of the proposal from Senator Gillibrand?
I think the proposals are reasonable. We've had such state legislation in New York State for since 2016 now, so it really won't change practice in New York State, but I think it's generally good for the rest of the country. I agree with Dr. Mendoza that the vast majority of patients who have acute pain require 7 days or less of a narcotic, and I would say that if someone's requiring more than that, they should be revisiting their doctor and talking about what their needs are. And I also would emphasize that this is for acute pain and not for chronic issues that really need you know, more of a doctor-patient relationship and possibly a pain specialist involved with pain that lasts that long.
Part of the reason we wanted Laura here is, I mean, I think of my own mother in Ohio who's has a very similar mindset about quality of life and opioids. And we've heard from many, many listeners who feel the same way, who are nervous. They're nervous. They see this kind of legislation, and the concern they express is exactly what Laura said, that I'm not going to be able to get individualized, basically a plan based on my needs with my doctor anymore if this happens. What would you say to that, Dr. Mendoza?
Yeah, I totally agree. Nobody wants cookbook medicine. You know, we want to take care of people individually and you know, with attention to their individual circumstances. And chronic pain is a real disease. You know, my worry, my fear has been that with all of the attention on opioids, that we're going to go too far. And, you know, might argue that we already have. But people with chronic pain are as deserving of our care and compassion as anybody else. And, you know, we've got to, you know, once this pendulum sort of settles down, you know, there are a whole lot of people. There are more people with chronic pain than there are with diabetes and heart failure combined. And this is a very real condition, and we're going to have to put some honest attention to it. And if it involves opioids, I think that's fine. But I do think that distinguishing between chronic and acute pain is very important.
We will come back to the subject of pain, because listeners, if you want to share your thoughts on that, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. At the risk of offending people who don't like generalizations about gender, I will just say this, Laura. I mean, are women just machines at dealing with pain and men are just soft? Because I've known you for a while now. We've traveled overseas together with the WXXI Travel Club. I've never even seen you so much as wincing.
You're kidding me, right?
No.
Well, I think that, you know what it is that we have, everyone has different levels of pain. And when it becomes, as my doctors have told me, just sort of part of your life, there's like, it's like a roller coaster because, you know, I'm in pain pretty much all the time, but some of it is, sometimes it's disguised, you know, like where it doesn't really feel like pain.
Are you in pain
like
right now?
Restless. I'm very restless and my knee is like killing me right this second, but that's a different story. You know, I've been playing with grandchildren all week, so that's what happens.
I just, you know, I've never even seen it. You're just amazing. I mean, like, I melt at the first sign.
Well, you
I have a mosquito bite that's bothering me.
Well, but you
it's
know,
a problem.
That's the thing about pain is that when it becomes just a part of your life, it's like everything else.
Yeah.
So no matter whether it's, you know, like just getting up early or going to bed early or whatever it is that you do on a regular basis, pain just becomes part of your life and just learning how to deal with it so that you can go ahead and function. And any kind of chronic disease is like that. I mean, diabetes is like that. If you have epilepsy, all kinds of diseases are like that. And that's why it's important to have good doctors who understand your care.
But do you think men are soft?
Depends upon the man.
Yeah.
You're okay. Soft.
Fair. As Vox points out, Senator Elizabeth Warren's plan among the presidential contenders is probably the most comprehensive. And let me read about what Senator Warren has proposed in regards to opioids in this country. It's called the CARE Act. It would authorize $100 billion to address drug addiction in the United States over 10 years, with the goal of dramatically boosting addiction treatment and other policy initiatives that can reduce overdose deaths. The money divided into several pots. Some would go to states, territories, tribal governments, while others would go to local governments and nonprofit programs. Some would be based on overdose levels. Others would go through competitive grants. Parts of the money would go to funding innovative treatment models, and some would be dedicated to expanding access to naloxone. Other funding would be dedicated to research, surveillance, and training for healthcare staff. And there is flexibility, Vox points out. The money in Elizabeth Warren's plan, for instance, can go to ideas that aren't related directly to opioids. But given that most overdoses today are linked to opioids, most of the funds would likely go to opioid-related programs, at least at first. It's also not limited to addiction treatment. Funding could go to, for example, needle exchanges or other harm reduction services, as long as there's evidence that such a program would reduce overdose deaths and does not violate the law. Dr. Mendoza, I'll start with you. That is pretty specific. It's also, you know, kind of a canvas that could be painted upon and changed. What do you make of the broad outlines you're hearing there?
You know, I think the themes are all right there. I mean, I think the first theme that I'm hearing is that there's going to be attention to addiction. And you know, overdose and the crisis that we're in is important, but if all we do is use Narcan, we're never going to get our way through this crisis. And so we do have to pay attention to the chronic disease of addiction. And I'm hearing a lot in her proposal that will address that. Prevention is number one. If we could find the root causes of addiction and prevent it in the first place, that would be ideal. But then treatment. Treatment of addiction is very important. You know, one thing I think is worth mentioning is that 10 years is a long time. You know, in 10 years, who knows what the drug of choice will be? It may not be opioids. It may be something else. And so, you know, I'm hearing flexibility in her proposal, and I think that's reasonable. Attention for opioids right now makes good sense. But, you know, the devil's in the details. I think, you know, harm reduction has its place. Medication-assisted treatment, very important for opioid addiction. And I'm hearing, you know, threads of all that, but I think the devil's in the details.
What do you make of the needle exchange programs or other harm reduction services?
You know, so to the point about evidence, the challenge with evidence is that it's hard to get, and it's really hard to rigorously study a lot of these harm reduction efforts. And they, some of them have been studied and have shown a lot of promise, and so I think it's very important to support those. Naloxone, Narcan, is a harm reduction approach. And so needle exchange, you know, that's been shown in a lot of communities to lead to fewer overdoses and to decrease the overall prevalence of addiction. So I think there's good sense in all that. And I think a multi-pronged approach, you know, for a very complicated problem makes a lot of sense.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but this is an issue that came up just a few days ago on this program. Monitored use clinics, still not really green lighted under the law in this country, but we've seen cities from everywhere from Ithaca to Philadelphia and others at least explore the possibility. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's a possibility. I think there isn't very good evidence for it. It's really kicking the can down the road. It's not an end-all, be-all treatment. It is a harm reduction approach. It's a way of helping people to be a little safer, but it's not safe. And so when people say it's a safe injection site, I think that's inaccurate. Supervised injection is a little more accurate. But at the end of the day, you're playing with fire. I think it's risky. But there is, you know, some, you know, initial evidence that it's starting to show some promise. But, you know, as a widespread policy approach, I don't think that's going to be enough.
Okay. if we get a lot more evidence, and I don't know where it would come from given the illegality of it right now, but if there were evidence that indicated that, yeah, let's call it monitored injection, or you know, as opposed to safe injection. I take the point. Injection itself is not really a safe thing to do, but monitored injection. If there's evidence that it reduces deaths, it reduces transmission of other disease, could you find yourself supporting it?
It would have to be legal first.
Yeah.
You know, from a county standpoint, obviously we wouldn't get behind a practice that's illegal.
Of course.
You know, I think we need to wait and see. I wouldn't go there now personally, because I think we have better evidence to support other practices that we know to work. And so I'm going to put my eggs in that basket for now. But, you know, I'm open to things, you know, and there are groups in this community who are studying the supervised injection idea. And I think that's important. We need to study it. We need to understand as best we can. But I think, you know, we have lower fruit to pick off right now, and I think I'm going to put my priorities there.
Dr. Apostolakis, when it comes to the broad outlines of the plan from Senator Warren, what are your first thoughts?
No, I concur fully with what Dr. Mendoza said, but specifically for URMC, it could really benefit our research into addiction and give funding. And you know, one of the main things that we do as a university medical center is to find new treatment strategies, find out more about diseases, and it could really help. As well as we're here to train the next generation of healthcare providers, and the funding for training would be very interesting to us as well.
Yeah, I think when people hear $100 billion over 10 years in this particular plan, and it's sort of the broad strokes of where the funding would go, if a chunk of that money comes your way, you mentioned research, but what exactly, right now, if someone gives you a check and says, go to it, you know, how do you envision using it?
Well, how I would envision using it is to set up or improve the organization of our community medication-assisted treatment. Right now, we have usually adequate access, but not always enough access to treat this chronic disease. And so I would like to study increasing areas that are able to, or units that are able to, accept patients at any time 24/7 for medication-assisted therapy. Right now, sometimes there's a linkage problem with patients who present to the ED to getting them into treatment.
Medication-assisted therapy, you want to offer a little definition for that?
I'm sorry. So
No, don't apologize. I mean, I'm familiar, but I think this is, if I'm hearing you correctly, that has a bit of a benign-sounding name, but it has some controversy in the field. Is that right?
Well, yes. So what we've been dancing around with addiction is really opioid use disorder. You can call it, it's similar to alcoholism, but which is another substance use disorder. But opioid use disorder is a disease that makes people crave the medication. They can't stop it. It affects their social life, their social interactions. It affects their jobs, and it can lead to overdose and death. You know, there's been discussion of detoxing patients, but that puts their levels of drug to zero and really puts them at increased risk for overdose when they go back, because recidivism is so high with this disease. So we identify it as a disease and treat it in a chronic way with medication-assisted therapy that prevents the cravings, prevents the social problems of having to steal, get money for drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And patients can be treated much like any other chronic disease, like high blood pressure or diabetes. And we got to start thinking of this as a chronic disease rather than something that patients can get over.
Medication-assisted treatment, what do you think?
So if you look at the origin of that term, it comes from this notion that we could treat addiction first through behavioral and psychosocial approaches, and medications would be an adjunct. But, you know, when you think about it, medication-assisted treatment is treatment. You know, we don't call insulin medication-assisted treatment for diabetes. And so, you know, I think that's an example, frankly, of stigma in our profession, where, you know, a treatment for a chronic disease is labeled something different rather than what it should be, medication or treatment. But, you know, it is essentially implying that you use medications in conjunction with other treatments to address a chronic illness.
My colleague Brett Dahlberg, in his reporting on this, spoke to you and noted that when you talked about stigma, you referenced that, generally speaking, for some older doctors in particular, there is medication-assisted treatment considered the gold standard for treating addiction runs counter to what they learned in medical school. Is that what you're encountering?
I'm going to count myself in that older group. When I was in medical school, you know, I don't think we had the level of openness around addiction that we have now. And, you know, I don't think we received the education that our students and trainees receive now. And I was led to believe that addiction was still somewhat of a choice and that people had a lack of willpower and so forth and that they just needed to sort of buck up and get over it. And we now know that that's not true.
I mean, I still remember Tommy Lasorda on Roy Firestone's show talking about Daryl Strawberry when he was coaching Daryl Strawberry when he was managing him on the Los Angeles Dodgers. And Lasorda railed and said, he has, you know, he's an alcoholic. He's got a weakness, not a sickness. That is a weakness. That's the manager of a superstar on national TV. That really was the mentality for a while.
I think it was. And, you know, I hope that we're heading in the right direction, but I'd be lying to you if I said that we're fully there. You know, I still see, and I still hear in all of the talks that I've given across the community, I still hear, you know, inklings of that stigma, inklings of that judgment. And, you know, the roots of that are complicated. But I think through conversation and, you know, exposure to people like Laura who, you know, thankfully have avoided addiction, but who have chronic illness mm-hmm. and other people who have addiction are normal, healthy people.
Yeah, I mean,
who
Laura,
struggle with an illness.
Laura, you think about yourself, you know, needing opioids at times mm-hmm. to maintain quality of life, but not ending up in a category of people addicted. Do you find yourself having sympathy for those who have that similar need but end up addicted?
Well, of course, because, I mean, it is a disease. That's the whole point, is that these are diseases that we're talking about. And just like with, it's not so much sympathy as needing, they need treatment, just like anyone else who is ill needs treatment. And making sure that you receive the proper treatment, whatever your disease is the most important thing.
Let me get a little feedback here. This comes from Arthur, who says, Evan, medical marijuana is an important alternative to prescription opioids for pain control. There needs to be more cannabis research. That won't be done adequately until marijuana is removed from Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. Let's work on getting it reclassified. Let's focus on how to get that done. Do you want to see that done, Dr. Mendoza?
Yeah, I'm surprised that we haven't legalized marijuana in New York State already.
Got pretty close this year.
We got really close.
Yeah.
You know, my position on that is that there are major public health implications and there are going to be major law enforcement implications. And we need to be prepared for all that. I think there is great promise in understanding what role marijuana might have in therapeutic areas. And we have medical marijuana now. And I think that's very reasonable, particularly because it's coming under the attention of a trained healthcare professional. So I do think we need more research. I don't think it's going to be the cure to the opioid crisis. I don't think it's going to be a one-size-fits-all cure for chronic pain. And my worry is that people paint it out to be this perfect panacea, and mm-hmm. it won't be that.
Dr. Apostolakis?
No, I agree. I think that there isn't adequate evidence. What I like about the question is I think there needs to be more research into it, but right now it's not the answer.
But if it's Schedule 1... Is the listener correct in saying when it's Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, there's a lot of limitations on what we can do to understand it? Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So I do suspect that a removal from Schedule 1 is not impossible and probably not that far off. Have you thought about medical cannabis at all?
Oh, I think about it all the time. My rheumatologist as part of a practice that is not prescribing that, and we have this debate all the time where I say, so you're prescribing opioids, but you're not prescribing medical marijuana. I don't understand that. So at this point, my care providers are not giving me that option. And I've played around a little bit with CBD oil, which does seem to have some sort of positive effect, but it's, you know, it's hard to tell about some of these things. And I would love to see much more research done so that doctors such as mine could say yes, no, maybe, whatever. And so the reality is that if I wanted to try medical marijuana legally, what I need to do is to find a practice that actually accepts new patients, very difficult, and that will prescribe. So it's been a little bit of a tricky situation. So no, I have not tried it, but I would very much like to give it a shot.
All right, we're going to get Jane in Rochester on the phone after our only break of the hour. Nicole emailed to ask, Evan, you keep mentioning Narcan, where to get it, what is it? So we'll return to that. I think that's a good moment to do that as we talk about the opioid crisis in our community. If you missed it at the top of the hour, the new numbers show that 2018 is the first time in Monroe County that we've seen a decrease in opioid deaths, overdose deaths, in a number of years. And it's a significant decrease. It does not mean we've cut it in half or that the problem has gone away. I mean, we still have nearly 200 people who died from overdoses in 2018. That's a huge problem. But we're talking about what is working and what might be in the future in terms of treatment, response, prevention. With Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Michael Apostolakis, who is Chief Medical Officer for the University of Rochester Medical Center, and our colleague Laura Garrison is here, a patient who has experienced long-term chronic pain, talking about the needs for opioid use in a responsible way for chronic long-term pain. She's our WXXI colleague, of course. So Jane and others, will get back to your phone calls and emails next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we're joined by Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law. He's coming to Rochester to talk about his book and the idea that segregation in this country was codified into law in many different ways. In our second hour, The Summer of Food takes a look at meatless meat. You know, the Impossible Burger and all the different iterations. Is it any good? Is it good for you? Where do you find it? Talk to you Thursday. So let me get Jane on the phone in Rochester first. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan. Back in the 70s, there was some practice of using hypnosis with people with various problems like tobacco or obesity, and that seemed to have disappeared. And I was curious if you had any information about what happened. Did it work? Was there some unintended negative consequence? But we don't seem to use that anymore. And, of course, it's just self-suggestion. It would seem to be pretty benign. But I'd like for your guests to comment on that, please.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. Doctors?
I can't tell you the last time that hypnosis was listed as a treatment. You know, and there are various types of hypnosis. I think today the contemporary analogy would be some sort of biofeedback or relaxation or meditation. I mean, there's good evidence for that. But actual hypnosis, you know, I think that carries a lot of different meanings. And so I guess I'd like to learn more about the about what is meant by hypnosis.
Okay. Dr. Apostolakis?
I would just say that non-narcotic pain relief, either with non-narcotic medications or massage therapy, meditation, other things, that music therapy, should all be considered. I think hypnosis in and of itself, there's really no evidence that that works, but these other non-narcotic, non-medication therapies have been shown to be helpful.
I suspect if we had good, you know, sort of good sample size studies that indicate hypnosis worked, we'd probably see it much more commonly.
Yeah, I would say so.
You thought about something like that or any of these other alternative treatments?
Well, I do all kinds of other alternative treatments. I use acupuncture regularly. I use something that's called myofascial release regularly. As a matter of fact, I'm going tomorrow. Very helpful, helping myself organize myself, some sort of meditation. I try to meditate every day when I am not making myself crazy doing other things. But I really do try all of that, and I do believe that it's all very helpful. I absolutely swear by acupuncture. I've had great relief from that.
Do you think it works, or do you think placebo is what's going on?
I believe it works, but clearly it's because I feel better. Now, is that a placebo? I don't know.
See, the problem I had with migraine I went for acupuncture during a migraine right before something that I could not miss. And so I was, you know, no atheist in a foxhole going to get acupuncture. And I walked out of there in 45 minutes feeling great.
There you go.
And I convinced myself, awesome, placebo's great. And the next time I needed it, I went to get it, and it didn't do anything for me because I probably thought, I'm just going to unleash my placebo as opposed to believing it worked. That's my...
Well, you
I'm,
know...
I'm a doctor, you can tell.
Well, see,
I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
There you go. See, that's what happens. But I can remember you actually having a Reiki treatment for a migraine, and that worked, too.
When we were in Spain. I do remember that. See, you'll try anything when you're desperate is sort of the message here.
I don't think it's desperate, though, but I have regular things. Like, I have a lot of, like, carpal tunnel syndromes. Like, my hands fall asleep at night, especially. And... I can't seem to get it, taken care of with either braces or with any medication or anything. And I have to tell you, the acupuncture, if I can tell when I haven't been for a while.
Oh, that's great. No, and before you email me, let me just say, I am not Doug and Reiki or anything else. I am a skeptic, and I am someone who believes in evidence-based medicine. I'm a big fan of studies and what the evidence tells us. But if something is working for you, I am not here to denigrate it. And whether that's placebo or something else, that is, listen, our bodies are amazing, powerful things. And for me, it has been when I've been desperate.
My rheumatologist did suggest hypnosis for me. I have not tried it.
That's interesting. But it sounds like, hey, if you found something that works. So Jane, I appreciate that. Nicole emailed to ask about where to get Narcan. What exactly is it? Who can get it? And this has been something you've worked a lot on, Dr. Mendoza, so let's hit this.
Thanks for your question. So Narcan is the antidote to an opioid overdose. Narcan will not have any effect if you're overdosing on anything else, and it won't have an effect if you just take it anytime. Narcan is the...
Hold on, I'm sorry. Let's back it up. If I took Narcan right now, nothing's going on in my body, but I'm taking Narcan, what happens to me?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Unless you're secretly overdosing...
Okay, nothing happens.
Nothing would happen.
Okay.
Nothing. It's perfectly inert to the body. It only acts on the body if the body is undergoing an opioid overdose. So here in New York State, we're grateful that we can get Narcan at any pharmacy without a written prescription. There is a standing prescription available across the entire state in New York that allows you to go into any pharmacy and ask at the pharmacy counter for Narcan.
Anybody can.
Anybody can. And in New York State, we also have a program called the Narcan Copayment Assistance Program, which allows up to $40 of any copay that you might have to be reimbursed to the pharmacy so that they don't end up having to bill you. And so for most people, unless you have no insurance, for most people, you can leave the pharmacy with Narcan free of charge.
Wow. Okay. So, Nicole, I hope that helps. And if you're interested, that means you can go to a pharmacy today and walk out with Narcan today.
Yes.
What does it look like?
So it looks like a little spray thing. It's a little smaller than Flonase, but it acts in very much the same way. You have a little plunger. You press it with your thumb. You insert the active end into your nose, and it sprays a mist into your nose. It's very similar to Flonase or Afrin or even nasal saline sprays.
How many people in this community do you think have it? I mean, I'm not asking for a raw number, but I mean in terms of what would satisfy you?
So I've personally... distributed 2,400 Narcan kits across the county. And I know that there's a lot more. We know what's going on at the pharmacies. I have no way of knowing.
Okay. But it's the kind of thing where you think every office building, someone on every floor, it should be everywhere.
Given the gravity of the crisis today, given that it's harmless, and you can't kill somebody with this, and people have no problems having an AED kit on the wall because everybody knows that cardiac arrest is something that you can prevent if you have the right treatment. But Narcan's even safer than that. And so from my standpoint, as long as we're in this this overdose crisis, there's really no reason not to have Narcan available.
How long do you have? If someone is having an opioid overdose, how long do you have to administer Narcan?
Well, you want to get it as soon as you can. But when somebody's overdosed from an opioid, they're not breathing. And as they're not breathing, the oxygen level in our body starts to decline. And, by most experience, 20 minutes without oxygen in your brain, even if you do come back, you may not come back the same person. And so we want to get people Narcan and breathing as quickly as possible.
Andrew wants to know about, he said, you mentioned medical marijuana, legalized marijuana. What about synthetic marijuana? Andrew, all right, so let me back up to Andrew's question. Andrew's asking about synthetic marijuana. I haven't heard that invoked in this community in a while, though I back in my commercial television news days, we did a half-hour special on bath salts and synthetic marijuana, K2 spice, things like that. And there was question at the time about what was being sold where, what was being allowed, because it was relatively new. This is almost a decade ago, probably. And bath salts, of course, were not actually bath salts. It was a drug. It was a, what's the word for a drug? What doctors? I mean, it was a, what kind of a drug? It's a, when I say it's a drug, it was a drug that people were overdosing on and doing really terrible things.
It was a hallucinogen.
Yes. Okay. So I haven't heard synthetic marijuana, though I will say, and I think he's probably okay with me quoting him back. This was almost a decade ago. Dr. Tim Wiegand. Strong
toxicology
told me that in his years, you know, working in a system that has an emergency department, he had seen maybe one person in the ER for marijuana, an overdose of actual marijuana, cannabis, and many in those recent years back at the time for synthetic marijuana. So it was a problem at the time. I don't hear it at all. And Andrew, if you're asking if it's any kind of a solution, it is not, I don't think. Dr. Mendoza?
You know, my worry about anything synthetic these days is that you don't know what you're getting. And, yeah, you know, we know, in fact, in our data that we released, 94% of the fatal overdoses involved fentanyl. And we also know at the same time that when we look at what these people thought that they used at the time of their passing, mm-hmm, none of them thought they were using fentanyl. So fentanyl is being mixed into heroin, into cocaine, into Xanax, into you name it. And that is the worry that we have with. So with anything synthetic, you know, it's buyer beware.
Whitney emails the program to say, with Narcan, does it force a heroin addict into withdrawal?
The answer is yes. If you do a lot, if you use a lot of Narcan all at once, yes, it could. When we train people, we advise spray every 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, and you'd avoid that if you use the Narcan. But I would much rather somebody be in withdrawal and living than the alternative.
Yeah, so honestly, it's not even a question I'd ever thought of. And on the subject of withdrawal, can I ask the doctors in the room a little bit about this question? Because on the complicated ways that we're trying to deal with opioids, you know, we've heard our friends in law enforcement talk about, you know, someone getting arrested and knowing that without much help, they're going to be rearrested. The recidivism's high. Withdrawal can be very powerful, can be very challenging. Let me ask both of you if you want to weigh in here. What do people need to know if they're going to be facing this? If they're, unlike Laura, if they're addicted and they want to get out of the throes of it, and they're worried about withdrawal, or maybe they've tried and struggled with it in the past, how serious withdrawal can be, what the antidotes can be for withdrawal, and when those symptoms might be alleviated. I'll start with Dr. Mendoza. Go ahead.
So withdrawal is an awful, awful feeling. Anybody who's been through it, I've seen it happen in patients, it's an awful feeling. It is the feeling that drives people to use. People use opioids in an addiction setting simply to feel normal. They are using to avoid that withdrawal. So, you know, if I could say one thing to a person who's worried about withdrawal, I would say this: treatment is available. Help is out there. And there is no one size fits all. Detox will work for some, inpatient will for some, outpatient for others. But help is available, and seek a qualified professional and have that person do a thorough evaluation of what you might need. And medications are available to manage the symptoms of withdrawal while we get you to the point where we could start using Suboxone, which can be a long-term solution among others for addiction. But help is available. We don't want anybody to be the next overdose.
You want to add to that, Dr. Pestalox?
Yeah, I would just say if you have a good PCP, your PCP should be able to assist you and get you into treatment. If you don't have a PCP, in the emergency room, we have social workers, toxicology specialists, addiction specialists who can meet and talk with you about the best plan.
I know Dr. Mendoza has cautioned journalists not to put too much emphasis on any one prong as we look at opioids. So an example of that is something that we might call detox beds. And one of the concerns I've heard raised among, for example, I talked to a mother who nearly lost a child, a son, an adult son. Concern was, number one, is insurance covering it? And number two, he needs more than 7 days or 10 days. You know, if you get this kind of treatment, but then you're tossed back out there, you know, she basically said, you know, he's going to have a relapse. What do you say to parents like that who are scared there?
I would say that you're absolutely justified in how you feel. Everybody's going to need more than 3 to 7 days of treatment, no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. Addiction's a complicated disorder. What I would say is don't be your own doctor. Get help, go to a qualified professional, have that evaluation done, and have somebody who's trained in the various modalities make recommendations for what you might need. And then, and as Dr. Apostolakis has said, going to your PCP, having a usual source of care. In my office, I'm happy to see people with addiction. And we want to take care of them for the long haul because we know that's what it's going to take. But, you know, I understand the desire for a detox bed because you just want your loved one to have safety and to be comfortable. And that makes perfect sense. I guess I would just emphasize that that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay. Let me get to Anna's point here. Anna says, Evan, your guest earlier said that there are many causes for the opioid crisis. I feel like there is one major cause, and it's poverty. We've got people who are out of work and out of hope, and no one seems to be talking about this. Okay. You know, I mean, so what I'll say to, as I kick it to our guests on that, Anna, is our guests are from the medical perspective. I mean, they're not elected leaders in government and setting national policy on economics. She's raising the point that people are turning to a needle or turning to heroin, to opioids, because they feel like there isn't hope. And that if you want to address this, you've got to find some sort of an economic cure. I don't know that you feel like this is your area. I mean, you're sort of operating with whatever the world is giving you, given that both of you are doctors. But what do you say to Anna?
Well, you know, this morning I was a doctor, and this afternoon I'll be the commissioner of health. And I can sort of play both sides. But what I think Anna is referring to are, you know, what we commonly call the social determinants of health. And there's no question that these social factors have a huge impact on people's health. And poverty is a big one. Racism is a big one. Access to care is a very, very big one. And all of these are not purely medical issues. If you really go upstream and try to understand what are the root causes for addiction, the CDC just put out, not even just, it's probably a year ago now, they now call it the Diseases of Despair, uplifting title. And those diseases are suicide, alcohol-related mortality, and drug-related overdoses. And when you look at these three causes of death combined, we're seeing common traces of their origin in racism, in poverty, in early childhood trauma. And these are very important. And quite frankly, these are areas that, you know, me and my doctor's office, I have a very hard time identifying, let alone doing anything about. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is where the public health side of things has a lot more potential. And if we could find as a community, I mean, we're a community that struggles with, you know, some of the highest concentrations of childhood poverty in the country. You know, we need to unpack that and understand what the role of that poverty is, because the last thing we want is another generation of people who are struggling through these diseases.
All right, as we get ready to wrap the program, as we talk about the opioid crisis, I want to ask all of our guests for some final thoughts. And I'm going to start with Laura Garrison, because she's kind of been the voice this hour of people who have chronic pain, who may be concerned that policy could eventually endanger their ability to get what you think you need here. Mm-hmm. What are your concerns going forward, and what do you want to see government do?
So pretty much I like the idea of putting money into treatment and research, because I think that that's really what needs to happen. And I think that the research could even have something to do with the whole issue of poverty and everything, because public health research is really important. I totally agree that I think that poverty is, you know, one of the biggest issues facing people with all types of different problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that solving that could solve a lot of other issues that we have. And those are the kinds of things that government is good at doing. I think dictating a specific policy to limit, say, prescriptions for a period of time, I can't see that that really is something that government should be getting involved in.
Okay. Dr. Apostolakis, what do you want to see next as we deal with opioids and the crisis in this country?
Well, first of all, I would just like to say in New York State, the funding for certified community behavioral health clinics that was supported by Chuck Schumer has been an immense help in our area in getting funding for a mobile crisis unit, more access to care for the indigent and others. And I think that continued funding of these important this type of important care is vital for the future if we're going to make this better.
Okay. Dr. Mendoza.
So two things. One, I would say, is that we've got to keep our foot on the gas with regard to Narcan, its availability, people understanding how to use it. You know, the last thing I want is for us to see what happened in 2015 and see the numbers go back up again. And so that would be my first hope. And then my second would be a direct call to my colleagues in primary care. If you haven't been trained in prescribing Suboxone or medication-assisted treatment, strongly consider it. You know, I think ultimately what's going to pull us out of this crisis is our ability to invite these people off of the streets and off of a place where they don't feel like they can get help and bring them into healthcare and provide them that love and compassion and care that we do for so many other conditions.
I want to read again. 2017, 287 opioid overdose deaths in Monroe County, 287, down to 195 last year. Is there any reason to think it's going to go in either direction? Do we have any sense of that yet, Dr. Mendoza, for
no.
this year?
I'm going to keep our efforts full court and hope for the best.
Thank you for taking the time and for your expertise in this. Dr. Michael Mendoza, Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County. And I want to thank Laura Garrison, our colleague here at WXXI, for telling her story. Thank you, Laura.
My pleasure, Evan.
I know you speak for a lot of people who are dealing with chronic pain in this community. Dr. Michael Apostolakis, Chief Medical Officer for the University of Rochester Medical Center, for your expertise as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Don volunteering with us today. Rob is the engineer. Megan is the producer. I'm Evan. Have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.